Some say the Torah or Old Testament is irrelevant, obsolete, or whatever adjective is used. And they say that for believers in Yeshua or Jesus as Savior. And often they cite certain Bible passages to bolster that claim. They say the Old Testament was then, but the New Testament is now. A recent video teaching in Sean Hilton's Be a Berean video series, that one's called Mystery of Double-Minded Scriptures on Grace and Law. And it compared about 24 such passages, and even more passages with the New Testament that seem to say the opposite. In the following study here, we look at two of these passages in particular, John 1:17 and Romans 3:28. One of the purposes of this series was to spark discussion and conversation with family, friends, and others to find out what the Bible is really telling us. Has the Bible been skewed to say what it doesn't?
What we're going to be going over today is we're going to be taking a look at something that you folks may have seen in the previous time, and then we are going to be taking a closer look at some of the particular passages that are included in this video. This is a video that Sean did a little while ago, and what it covers are a number of the particular passages that are often brought up when people are saying, well, you know, the Torah is irrelevant, obsolete, you pick the adjective that people want to use to describe it, for those who believe in Yeshua, basically. The Old Testament and the Torah was then, the New Testament is now. It's all about grace and truth now and no longer about the law. So we're going to be taking a look at the video is going to bring this up. And the video is a starting point for people to kind of study on their own and to start asking questions. And you may have had other people come up to you with these sorts of questions. And then afterward, the video, we're going to be looking at some of these passages specifically and taking a look at what these particular answers are. And there may be some others in this list, and maybe some others that are not on the list that are also have been brought up to you. And what we'll probably do is, at that point, take a bit of a bookmark on those particular passages and then take them up in the next session as we continue on. So this session, we're going to be looking at four passages in particular. John chapter 1 verse 17, Romans 3 verse 28, Romans 4 verse 5, and Galatians 3, 24 through 27. So those are the ones we're going to be tackling specifically. There may be some others in this list. So as we're going through here, try to jot down, you know, like, oh yeah, I've heard people mention that to me before, and we can take a look at these things in more detail. Because one of the purposes of the series is to start the discussion among your family members, your friends, other people you're around, as, you know, what is the Bible really telling us? And has there been a skewed view of what the Word says that is making it say something differently than what it does say? And you may have encountered people who say that your position is making the Bible say something differently than what it does say or what they think it says. So that's the starting point, and we're going to move on to these passages and perhaps some others we'll take up at a later point in time. All right, so we are going to kind of go into some of these passages here. I hope you also, as you were going through there, noted some of the passages here that you may have heard yourselves and people have brought up to you, and we can pursue those in our next session go around. The first one we're going to be taking a look at is John chapter 1 verse 17, which we'll kind of take a look at it in a few different versions here so you can see some of what we're looking at, and you can see some of the questions that have come up. This is first from the King James Version. For the law was given by Moshe, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. And this is from the New International Version, also the English Standard Version, or the ESV, also has this rendering. For the law was given through Moses, but in grace and start that over again. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And the New American Standard Bible has, for the law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. So you'll note there in the New American Standard that they also have a margin note in there that they note that what they translated as were realized could be translated came to be, or you know, came into existence would be another way to put that. So with that, people have taken that as to be that there's some sort of tension here between the continued relevance, the continued importance of the Torah, the commandments, and what the life of a believer in Yeshua, one who is trusting in Yeshua's sacrifice as being the means of salvation. So one of those things that has really popped up is because of this is actually the verse before it in verse 16. Because if you look at, let's take a look at verse 16 here, and that's where you really start to get this train that gets rolling. And once the train gets rolling, it starts leading down different paths, depending on what locomotive you have pulling it at any given time. So we're looking at John 1, verse 16. For of his fullness, this is here from New American Standard, for of his fullness we have received in grace upon grace. And various renderings of this have, like the King James Version has grace for grace. The New International Version has grace in the place of grace already given. And a number of them have the grace upon grace or grace after grace as being the renderings of this. And where this all comes from is the where you have the phrase keren anti keritos. So keren, let me just transliterate it out here. Keren. Now, you might recognize this little part. This is what we get grace from in the Greek word. Charity. And now charity, what we think of charity, actually comes from the Greek word of agape. We talked about that when we were going through John. But where we have this, where we have keren from, this term here of grace or favor upon somebody like that is where we have the situation comes in. Now, what actually then comes into the problem is the preposition that comes right after that, which is anti. Not like you're anti, but this is anti as in we think like anti, as I guess you would say it in most American vernacular. And you're always thinking, well, it's anti-something. You know, you think of anti-Christ, anti-this, anti-that. That's anti-establishment. So we get this idea it's against. Or as you look in a lot of lexicons here, they'll say something that indicates an exchange or a succession from the Thayer's lexicon. Traditionally, it or universally means instead of. So when you see this, a lot of where people are looking of is instead of. So where you get this now in verse 16, you've got this grace instead of grace.
So you say in verse 16 it says instead, or that word anti.
Yeah, because depending on what does your translation say at the end of it?
It says, and of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace.
Yeah, grace for grace. Now the phrase grace for grace comes from the Greek phrase karin anti karitos. Karitos. And that is this preposition here, anti, is how it often gets used throughout Scripture and in classical Greek literature is the idea of it, and you'll see a lot of lexicons have this, well, it means universally instead of. So then you had a lot of people then take this meaning, well, okay, there was a grace before, and then there's a grace after. So then they take the next verse there, John 1:17, where it's saying, well, the law, grace and truth. Well, okay, the first thing that was provided, the first favor that God extended down was the law. But then that was instead of, the next thing that came instead of that was then grace and truth. So that was something that came later. So then you have that idea starts rolling, that train starts leaving the station, that this is something different that God is doing, that God is packed onto the train heading out of town, that the old law that's been leaving town, and so he's now bringing in something different called grace and truth.
What he brought in was Colossians 1:19, for it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. Yep. So all fullness came into Christ.
Yeah, all fullness. So right. So that is one of the things where we get this train rolling towards saying that this is something different than what God is doing. But one of the things that you see that's also in older Greek literature, like in, there's an example of this in Philo, the name's spelled P-H-I-L-O, when he was writing about kind of where God's mercy came down and talks about, uses the phrases of karin and anti in there. It is, he talked about it as a succession. There was, God gave this and he gives this. He gave this, this is his first gift, and now he's giving you a second gift. So that's why you're starting to see modern translations are saying grace upon grace. Yeah, because then you start going back into Greek literature and you start seeing it show up again as karin anti karitos is a phrase that means good stuff and even more good stuff. You know, this idea of something, you have got good, something good, and then even something more upon you. It's like filling up even to greater abundance. So that's when you start seeing these modern translations when they're saying grace upon grace or grace after grace. These are talking about a rolling together of great things that God is doing. So then when you come down into the greater part of this, one of the things that we've talked about before as we were going through John is that, you know, is Daniel here has talked about when going through the word about the idea of a chiasm. Yeah, not a chasm, which is a giant hole you can fall into, but a chiasm here is it's a type of structure of poetry in which you have it. Sometimes it's kind of like if you were to describe it, it kind of looks like this. We've got one line here and a line here, a line here, and then a line here. And so in an entire passage, you'll have these, and it just looks like a straight section of text. But what you have going on is a first part of it will match the last part of it. This part, the next part will match a part near the end of it. And it keeps going and going and going until there's one part that is unique in and of itself. And that's called a chiasm. There's different ways that this can be structured, but it's the idea that you have pairings of ideas. You've got an idea show up in one place of a passage, and you've got an idea show up in another place of a passage. So if you're going through the Bible and it looks repetitive, it's like, well, I read that before. That's a good hint that you are getting, most likely coming across a chiasm, meaning that there's a part of a structure here that is pointing you toward something toward the middle of this. And John chapter 1 is a chiasm. There's a number of chiasms actually in the book of John in particular. But the chiasm here kind of centers on The passage that we're looking at here in John verses, really like 16 through 18 is where this chunk is that matches up. And it matches up with another part in verses 1 through 5. So when you look in verses 1 through 5 of John, you'll start seeing some thematic ideas that are very similar to the passage we were just looking at in John 1 verses 16 through 18. So in the beginning part of this, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it, or did not overcome it, or could not overcome it. So this combines here with this passage that we were looking at before in verses 16 through 18. And one of the things that you see in those patterns together is that this idea of light coming into darkness and being overtaking the darkness with it, that there was some progressive things that happened. And as you see in the beginning part of it, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And then the beginning, as it moves forward, then through verse 5, you have this idea of light shining out in the darkness. And you combine that with the last part of it in verses 16 through 18, and you see that instead of this anti, this idea of opposition, that the law was in opposition to or had to be pulled out of the way for something better than to come in, what you then have is that this is a progression of God's mercy that comes forward. And we'll be getting to more. Well, it's including, but adding it on top of it. And we'll be getting to that in just a moment as to why this is a grace or favor that God is bestowing, not only the law of Moses, but also grace and truth. So that's why you'll see a lot of modern translations will have in verse 17 of chapter 1, they won't have the but there, because that's a Greek word that could be translated as a conjunction, either meaning and or but. There's kind of like three different ones. We have and or but, most likely but or something like that, to say that you have two sentences that you're gluing together in a conjunction. Yes, that's right. So instead of those that we have either day or kai or Allah, and kai is a common one because it can be a bit confusing sometimes with kai, because kai is can either be understood as like and or but, and you really have to judge on the context of it as to which one it's referring to. But none of those words are actually between these ideas. So that's why you'll see modern translations just stick a semicolon in there. It's just like, it sandwiches them together, but they're not saying that one's in opposition to the other or this or that, because that's not what the underlying Greek text says, anything of the sort. So thus you have that idea that what God is doing is something that is progressive, revealing a progressive idea of mercy. So let's look at the next passage here in Romans 3:28. And we'll look at that in a few versions here. First, with the King James Version. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. And then we have it from the New International Version, I'm sorry. For we maintain that a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. And then from the English Standard Version, which is very similar to New American Standard in this regard. For we hold that one is justified by faith apart from works of the law. So this phrase that we have, works of the law, and it shows up a number of times. And the main places where you see them is in Romans and Galatians. So I'm going to write it up here, works of, I'm going to put the here in brackets here just for a moment, because the underlying Greek of this, ergon, namu. Namu is a kind of a variation of nomos, or what we could say is law or ways of order. And ergon is work. So between those, ergon, namu, that's more literally, it just says works of law. So the is added in there by the translators as being, oh, what law is it? Well, the translators added works of the law to make it specific to what the law of Israel is, a decision that the translators made on this. So the question is that correct? Do you actually have a situation where you're talking about the law, works of the law? And is the work of the law in justification by faith? Well, one of the things that we had just noted in the video we're going over, and something was hammered home, is that with this big word, you know, in English we call it justification. Justified just simply means when you look through here, is not guilty. You know, we load it with this big word, but it just simply means not guilty or declared not guilty. It's really a very action-filled idea of being justified is declared not guilty. So the question that comes in is that, well, where does this, how is one declared not guilty? And one of the things we'll be looking at here is that you'll see in not only in the Torah itself, but also in the writings of the apostles, is that this is something that comes through trust. Trust in God. Trust in God. That's the message that we get throughout the scriptures, that trust in God is where this God declaring us not guilty comes from. And it goes all the way back to Abraham there. And God declared him righteous, not guilty of anything, because he trusted him. Trusted him in what? Trusted him in the promise that he was going to give him a son, and that through that son was going to be the blessing for all the nations. And that trust in him was tested then to the point of saying, give me your one and only son. The son that I promised you were going to have and I gave to you. Then I said, now take the life of that son, but trusting that God was still going to make that happen. And even then revealed later that trusting to the point that God was able to bring him back from the dead. So that is, that trust kept building to the point of actually losing the great promise and the great hope. Because you have to remember how many decades it was that they were praying and waiting and then waiting for this to happen and then having it happen and then now being faced with it being taken away. So this idea of trusting God being the foundation of God declaring you not guilty or justified goes all the way back to the beginning. But, so we're saying like, well, okay, well, if we're, it's clear here from the word that we are justified by trust in God, you know, called faith in God. Well, then what is this idea of works of law, works of the law, ergon namu? Now, you may have encountered this, since some greater translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls started appearing in the early 90s, like in 94, 1994, there was a translation that came available of a part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you'll, if you want to look it up, it's, you'll see it described as the document 4QMMT. And it talks about some of the, and it's called the, like, righteousness documents, about how one is declared righteous. Because we were talking about justified. How is one declared justified in the community? And that 4QMMT, as, you know, this, these are written in Hebrew, Hebrew texts, and in this 4QMMT is the Hebrew phrase that shows up, Ma'aseh HaTorah. Ma'aseh HaTorah. Now this phrase here, you know, we sing the song, Oseh Shalom, you know, making peace. Aseh is together with bara, or two words that you have of making something. In Genesis chapter 1, you see aseh and bara used quite a lot in there. Aseh is more of a general term of making, forming, creating, bringing something into being. And as we've talked about with like moed and such, when you sometimes when you have these this mem added in the front of a word, it means like the place or the specific of something. So thus you get with ma'aseh is the works or the deeds. Aseh is, or ma'aseh can be sometimes called like a deed or something that you do. So deeds is what you have, deeds of HaTorah. And HaTorah in this specific context is the deeds of the Torah. And when you look into this document 4QMMT, you'll notice a number of things in there as to what are considered to be the deeds of the Torah that are, makes you can be considered to be into the righteous category for the particular community. And some of those include Shabbat, they include circumcision, and then they go on with a long list of some other things. You might say, well, okay, that's getting a little nitpicky. But then also with Shabbat, you get into some other things of what specifically is meant by Shabbat and what specifically is involved in happening on Shabbat and what is you should be doing on Shabbat and not doing on Shabbat. So what you end up having with this document for QMMT is this is what is considered to be standard. You know, you might have heard the phrase member in good standing. So this is the document that tells what a member in good standing of this community was. So if you were out of compliance with this document, then you'd be considered to be on the outs.
So that was made up in 1994 when they found the scroll. Is that what you're saying?
The translation. The translation says, became available of 4QMMT. Because you have to remember, if you've seen anything of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's a giant jigsaw puzzle with the number of them. There's fragments of all sorts of stuff, and they've just now started developing new techniques of figuring out what are on the fragments and how the fragments go together. So the, even though they discovered them back in 47, it's taken a long, 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 long time to come up with translations of some of the documents. Because Isaiah scrolls easy because it's like all there. But a lot of the other ones, not so much. And there are not many copies of them. So it's a giant puzzle trying to figure out what they are all about. So they've come up with some of these in more recent years. Well, as this thing started to pop up here for QMMT, this is one of the, pretty much the outside picture, outside of Paul's writings, of a phrase, anything similar to works of law. In fact, it's nearly identical. You just switch that over to Hebrew, and it's the same phrase, works of the law, works of law. So the question then comes in, well, this gives a new perspective of what Paul is talking about here. Because you start going back and looking at the places where you see works of law show up, you know, you'll see it in Galatians chapter 2, verse 16, Galatians 3, verse 2. You'll see it in verse 5 and verse 10 of Galatians chapter 3. And you'll also see it in Romans 3, verse 20, and here in the passage we're looking at in verse 3, verse 28. So, as you're looking back and seeing, well, around the first century time period, when you had communities out there were kicking around these ideas of works of law, and this document here talking about what is considered to be acceptable behavior, now you start to see what some of the discussions are, especially in Galatians. Because what do you have a lot in Galatians about? Circumcision. You know, about whether you should be circumcised, not circumcised, what does that all mean? And one of the things you see, and we talked about this going back to even the time of the Maccabean period, related to Hanukkah and such, that commemoration of the rededication of the temple, one of the big things that came through from Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, is epithet there. But one of the things that he came through was any sort of works of the law at that time period would put you in the realm for death. He was going around taking out people who were circumcised, taking out people who were respecting the Shabbat or any of the other appointed times, or even studying the Torah or studying the writings, anything that was like contrary to the prevailing worship of the time period. So this idea of what was considered to be acceptable in the community was hugely a big deal in like the first couple of centuries BC and even into the first century AD, the time of when Paul is writing. It's a major identity issue, hugely big identity issue, because you're talking about a time period when your ability to worship God freely was hugely in jeopardy. And then you see later on in Roman history, when they started coming after the Jewish believers, they were coming after them based on, okay, well, you act a certain way, you are different, and then coming after you. Your Maaseh HaTorah landed you into serious jeopardy. So one of the things that we see as we go into this passage here, as we're looking at in Romans 3:28, as we roll this back into it, you read that back in, and it's like, well, we hold that one is justified by faith. Okay, well, that's established back from the time of Abraham, apart from works of the law. Because when you get down to these, whether it be the people who were involved in writing the Dead Sea Scrolls, or as you see, even in the time of the Pharisees and the various sects of the Pharisees, they had their own Maaseh HaTorah. They had their own views. And you see some of that showing up in the Gospels. You'll say, like, well, some people fast 2 times a week. And then you'll see in other writings of the first century that some people fasted on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and some on Mondays and Wednesdays, and some even had variations on that. And looking down upon others who had a different belief and a different practice. So one of the things you'll see is a bit of a subtext going on here. A subtext that you have to understand what was actually going on at the time these things were written. Because whether you're reading Galatians or Colossians or Ephesians or something, you'll be seeing that you're looking at someone else's mail. You're looking at two other people who are communicating. And you were also seeing only one part of the conversation, especially like in Corinthians and such, you're having to guess at what some of the issues are that are involved. Sometimes it becomes pretty clear, but in some cases not. So one of the things that you're seeing is a subtext of these arguments and saying, look, you are justified by your trust in God and God's Messiah, not by Maaseh HaTorah, not by what your sect, your denomination says is the way to worship God, and then viewing some other denomination's view of worshiping God as debased, evil, heretic, you know, unbelievers. I mean, really, when you see some of the first century writings like the Mishnah, you get that idea that if you were varying into different parts of view, you were viewed as being outside of the kingdom. And like talking about, when we're talking about circumcision here in Galatians, well, yeah, you know, for the uncircumcised, they were, as you read some of those rabbinical writings, they were viewed as being outside of the kingdom, doomed for destruction. Those that did not follow Shabbat in certain ways were doomed to destruction, being outside into the outer darkness. So as you're kind of looking under the hood of all these verses here that use just this phrase, the works of the law or works of law, what you're seeing here is a railing against a particular view of the time period. And that is a lot of what you see in the Gospels and in the epistles, the writings of Paul, Peter, James, whatever. They're talking about specific sorts of things that they're railing against, errant teachings that they're railing against. And so that's one of the things that you have to keep in the back of your mind. Now, when you're talking to other people like this, you're like, well, is the point of all of the looking at these passages just so that you have your trump card, that when someone brings this up, you can just whip out your trump card and go, aha, you are wrong, and then beat them over the head with a club, or yeah, beat them over the head with a Bible? But the point, though, was when you start seeing these passages like in Romans chapter 14, where Paul is advocating, it's like, look, if you're dealing with people who are weaker in faith, you know, don't, you know, as to use an old King James, lord it over them. Don't, you know, use your knowledge, whatever you think you have, as a weapon to make them feel bad or to even oppress them. You know, Paul uses in Romans 14 the phrase, you know, that we're not going to condemn someone for food and drink. So the point of all this is what? Not to win an argument, but to show what God is doing. So what is it that God is doing? We looked at there in John chapter 1, verse 17. You know, it's not that, oh, the King James translators really goofed it up and we've been dealing with it ever since. No, that's not the issue. It's that, what is God actually doing here? It's grace upon grace. He started out with a huge gift to humanity, with showing what is right, what is wrong, that there is a God, there is a creator, and then just keep rolling it out. Further ideas of who God is. You know, the prophets coming along and expanding that even further. And then, you know, our forefathers in the Commonwealth of Israel having to go through all kinds of struggles, exiles and such, to show us what it is that God is looking to do. Then God sending his son as an example of what it is God is trying to do. On and on and on. So one of the great points here of this works of law discussion, the Maaseh HaTorah, is that what is God going to respond to? Your magic charms? You know, you do a little dance in a certain way, to a certain steps, to a certain rhythm and such, and God's going to take notice? Or is it where your heart is at? You hear what God is saying and you respond to that. You hear what God is saying and you respond. Because if you look at what it was that the Messiah was encountering there in the first century, you had those who were, you know, they had gone with what they've been taught before. And suddenly then when they heard the words of God, you know, you see it there in the Gospels, they're like, we've never heard anybody talk like this before. Because, you know, they've been steeped in a world of Maaseh HaTorah. That is, you know, a key access to God. Now, there is the idea in that, what is your approach to God? Now, when you look at Maaseh HaTorah and the things that different congregations, different, quote, denominations, sects of either the Pharisees or other groups of the time period, you look at any individual ones of those and go, well, that's helpful. You know, that's a helpful practice. Circumcision is something, like Paul says, circumcision is only of value if it's a part of your whole heart experienced connection to God. If you think it's going to do anything for you as a, you know, a magic charm, you're kidding yourself. You're kidding yourself and mutilating your flesh is basically, you're just getting an operation for no good reason. So the same thing with Shabbat. If it is not something that is connecting you to God, connecting you to other people, connecting God to the world and such like that, you're just killing 24 hours that you could be doing something else. If it is not something that is actually connecting with God and connecting God with humanity, connecting humanity with God, then it is just a waste of time. And it goes on and on and on for anything you want to put into the Maaseh HaTorah or the works of the law category. Is you're wasting your time if you really think that that's going to get you declared not guilty before God. Because there is only one thing that gets God's attention. And that is what the starting point is. The starting point is to trust him in what he says. Now, after that, that's where you start, you know, as we were looking at before, you know, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Then after that sort of reaction is, I've been declared not guilty. Then what it is that you do? Where do you go from there? That's where any of the practices that are profitable, you know, come into play. Whether that is something that connects you to God or not. It's where is it? Is it helping you connect to God or getting in the way between you and God? Those is where you really, and then where this really comes into play, the Maaseh HaTorah comes in, is someone else then uses it as a hammer to hit you over the head with, because you are not doing it the way that their group says that you should do it. And that when you read Paul's letters, that's what you see. You see that one group is saying, you know, Acts chapter 15, you'll see that same situation. You have to be circumcised to be saved, because you see that right at the beginning of the Mishnah. You know, if you're not circumcised, you're out. You're out of the kingdom and basically lost. So not eligible. And that is a horrific situation, because you'll see Acts 15 goes on and they discuss it. And it's really, Acts 15 is kind of an outgrowth of Acts chapter 10, where you really see where the real pull in the, of what God is doing is all about.
Yeah, the circumcision isn't going to change your love for God. I mean, you could get the circumcision as an adult and already still love God, be giving, be doing,
the
and
point
go
is,
and get the
is
procedure,
why?
Right? Why are you getting it?
Why are you doing it? That is the point.
You're getting it
because
somebody else thinks you
Well, see, that's the thing. If someone else thinks you should, we're back into the Maaseh HaTorah category again. If someone else thinks that you should do that, and so you do that. Right. Well, you see the thing though, there are various, you could say, disciplines like, you know, fasting and praying and stuff like that. They are beneficial between you and God and stuff like that. Now, if then someone else is coming to you and saying, you are not holy, that you are separated from God, going in a different direction if you are not a vegetarian, if you are not fasting on a certain schedule, if you are not getting some sort of manifestation, then you are totally separated from God. That's back into the Maaseh HaTorah. You are not following a given group's views of what is then considered to be That's where a lot of that, of what Messiah is getting at is, you know, do not judge lest you will be judged. So it's not saying that there is no standards ever for anything, but is not, don't take God's place and start saying who is in the kingdom and who's out of the kingdom. That's what Maaseh HaTorah is all about, is saying who is in the kingdom, who's not in the kingdom. And when you start getting into that sort of category, then you get to be a problem. And you see why Paul and Peter had a big falling out there at that particular meeting, was that, you know, he was separating himself from the non-Jews at a particular meeting. Why? Because the Maaseh HaTorah of a number of the sects of the Pharisees were saying that, you know, unless you would go through the whole conversion process based on a particular sect or a house of the Pharisees, then you were not considered to be fully in, and then you are getting polluted by contamination. So that is one of the cases there. Now, this helps as we look forward into all of the other part of Romans. As you look on in Romans, you'll see this discussion carried further. So when, another thing to keep in mind is that when you're talking with people and they'll bring up passages from Galatians or Colossians or Ephesians or Corinthians, it's remember that Romans was the last one. It was near the end. It was to get like some of the letters of Titus and such are like at the very, very end. But Romans comes very near the end. And as you'll notice in it, it is a complete thought, idea. This is not like just randomly, you know, responding to people's this and that and the other. It is a complete thought when you start it and as you go through to the end of it. And then you have conclusionary stuff in the last chapters of it. But in Romans, you are getting a fully thought out response to what it is that Paul was really saying and trying to get at. And what do you see in Romans? You'll see it repeatedly in there where he is saying, you know, does this mean that the law is sin? By no means. He goes on in these things because why? He is responding to a number of these accusations that people were making that he was teaching something completely different. And you see in Acts chapter 21 where Paul is making one of his trips in back into Jerusalem, and he meets with the council, and they're saying, well, look, we heard great things that you're doing out there, but people are getting this idea that you're trying to teach, you know, the people of Israel to then go out and they don't have to listen to what Moshe wrote anymore. You don't have to listen to that anymore. So he says to them in Acts 21, when you read this, and this kind of continues on for the next few chapters as he goes before Felix and then he goes before Festus. This keeps continuing on, this discussion with what is it that Paul was actually teaching. And we saw some of that in the video of what it was that he was clarifying and saying, look, I have not taught against the prophets. I've not taught against the Torah. I've not been speaking against the temple. And even the deacon Stephen in the kind of earlier on in Acts even gets to that point too. These accusations that are made that I have been teaching against the temple and such are just not accurate. So one of the accusations that gets made, that gets put into Paul's mouth, is that he has been teaching that, okay, the Torah is now set aside. The law of Moses has been set aside. And there is something new that's coming on the scene. Well, the point though is that Paul specifically said, no, that is not what I've been doing. And when you read Romans, he clarifies what it is that he's actually talking about. Well, what is God actually doing? And as you see in Romans, and it kind of brings us out in the passage that's a number of us know quite well in Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 20, where, you know, I did not come, and I do not think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. And with this, we get what God is actually doing. Because that word that we have for fulfill, which is the Greek word of pleroo, is used in a couple of really interesting ways. When you see it, it's used a lot, like when you see in the Gospels or in the epistles, where it says, and this so was fulfilled, what was said through the prophet so-and-so. That word is pleroo, that this was fulfilled. Okay, well, what then is fulfilled? The number of varying definitions you can have for it, again from the Thayer's lexicon, is to make full or to fill up. But another possibility is to render complete, to make it complete. Well, we think of to make it complete means, okay, it's over. But one of the things that you see throughout Scripture is the idea of to perfect something, to make it perfect, to make it complete, means to make it not missing anything anymore. We see, and one of the key uses of pleroo in this sense of making things full is in, we'll just close with this, in Matthew chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. And Yeshua arrived from Galilee at the Jordan, coming to Yohanan to be baptized by him. But Yohanan tried to prevent him, saying, I have need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me? But Yeshua answered, saying, permit it at this time, for in this way it is fitting for us to fulfill, to pleroo, all righteousness. So if we were to take this idea that pleroo means to make it over, to bring to an end, I mean, we would be making the saying that this was done to end all righteousness. Now you could take that even further and say, well, what is it that we're bringing to an end? Baptism? Now, that's kind of an interesting teaching, that you're saying that Yeshua brought baptism to an end there at the Jordan. Well, I guess then what does that mean about the practice of baptism then after the time of Yeshua at the river, if he brought that to an end? Or did he make it complete? It now has a full meaning. Because, you know, baptism didn't just drop out of the sky there in the Gospels. It is a practice, you know, known as going for a mikvah or a washings. And this came down into the first century through various Ma'asei HaTorah, or various traditions, largely the Pharisee traditions, of what these washings meant. You know, one of the things we've talked about before in different settings is that one of the Pharisees' innovations was to take the things related to the temple and the tabernacle and to take that out into the world around you. So thus, the things that you see in the Torah that relate to what the priests would do in the tabernacle were then things that were extended into what the common people would do. And the idea of washings, that this was a personal thing that people would do, individuals would do, beyond if you were leprous or had some other sort of thing that you needed to be cleansed for, that this was something that was then a normal thing that people would do and a normal course of worship as you were going up to the temple. This then idea of the washings that you saw both in the Psalms and in the prophets, that God is going to wash and cleanse with living water, and that these living water was going to flow out from Jerusalem down into all the earth. This picture of washings was something that God was going to do to wash away all of the sin, the transgressions and iniquities from all of the people. Well, Yeshua is bringing this thing forward and saying, look, I'm the one who's making the mikvah, the washings, complete. Makes it really the full meaning of it. Because it's not just the hope anymore. And it's not just the, you know, I cleanse off the physical dirt on my body. It is that there is an actual means that God is washing things away, and that is through the Messiah. Messiah being one who's going to wash these things away. So, in all of these things, you know, both in these and in others that you may encounter, one of the things to go back on is one of the things that Messiah says here, not only just in Matthew chapter 5, verse 17 through 19, but also in Luke chapter 16, verse 16 and 17, where he's saying that this is not what I've come to do. I'm not coming to change it. I'm not coming to do away with what God has said, to bring in something new. I'm bringing it to its fullness, to its completeness, that it will be absolutely not lacking anything. And so, if I'm then bringing it to completion and not lacking anything, I want you then to be complete and not lacking anything. So that is what God is doing. And I guess a good lesson about the Maaseh HaTorah is that the practices that you or somebody else is telling you that you should be doing related to the making complete, if that is getting in between you and God, or getting in between someone else and God, then you really need to start taking a close look at it and seeing if, you know, some of the Messiah's warnings and even Paul's warnings about these sorts of things, that if this indeed is something that we are, as Paul puts at it right in the beginning of Galatians, we are preaching a different gospel. We are preaching different news about the kingdom. The news that we are giving about the kingdom of God is different from what the kingdom of God actually is. So one of the things that we just need to make sure of. And in closing, we don't want to get into the same question of the word of God that was in the garden. Did God really say? Did God really say, yeah, this is a statue forever? Did God really say that this is something that is for both the native born and the stranger, the foreigner? Did God really say that this is something that's going to be happening, you know, in the new heavens and the new earth? Did God really say, and on and on and on and on? And one of those things that's, you know, really looking at God's word and in its totality, bringing it to its fullness, is that there is no longer old. There's no longer new. This is all the testament. This is all the witness of God. There's no old witness, obsolete witness, new witness, replaced instead of witness. This is all the witness of God. This is who God is. No, you know, fearsome father and gentle Jesus anymore, but this is all witness of the same God that we're looking at. So,
the 4QMMT,
yes.
Do you have any idea, do they have a sense as when it was written and who wrote it?
Well, the dating of the Dead Sea Scrolls are, oh, they put those kind of into a realm of like the somewhere between the first century BC and the first century AD. Some of them even have it kind of ending at the first century BC. Some of them maybe considered going back to a couple of centuries before that, like maybe a couple centuries BC. That's like the totality of all the scrolls that were in there. 4QMMT, well, that particular one is in the same community as all the other ones. It follows like the similar writing style, the similar way of writing the letters and such. So the same group of people wrote it. Well, some people think it's the Essenes, but then some of what we know about the Essenes kind of fit into a different group. So there are people that are really in two different camps as to whether it was the Essenes, when we only really know about the Essenes through like Josephus and very peripheral writings about who they were, what they believed. But some of what you see, whether they were monastic, whether they were exclusionary, whether they were inclusionary, things are all over the map on that. So One of the things that you do see is that there was this idea of the supernatural, the ideas of similar things that you see in Yohanan's writing, John, about darkness and light, the sons of darkness, the sons of light. You see some of those themes in there. So a lot of the undercurrents that you get in some of the sects of the Pharisees also get blended in there. So it very well may have been, considering what you read about Herod and such, these people could have been a mixture of various sects of people that just said, I've had it, and I'm heading out into somewhere else to hang out or to preserve the various writings. And boy, we're sure thankful they did. Because, you know, without the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, we would be left with just the some of the codexes that date to about 800 A.D., 800 to 1100 A.D. So, you know, without the Dead Sea Scrolls, we wouldn't have, you know, something to really know that things had not changed much over time period. And so you could really look back and see that God's word had not changed really materially much. But, you know, that's really a very interesting question as to who these people were. You can sort of guess who they were based on the content of what they were writing. But, wow. I guess we need to wrap up here. So, just in closing here, are there any passages that either of the list that we kind of looked at in the video or any other ones that people have brought up that you really have a question about, and we can tackle them in the next session? Because one of the things that we'll also want to do in the next session around is go into some of what's underlying this idea of the Maaseh HaTorah in the various views of the Pharisees and such that are underlying the things that you see both in the Gospels and in Paul's writings as well. Yes. Romans 7:25. Okay. Anything in particular about Romans 7:25? Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll take a look at that one. Titus 3:20. Okay. We can take a look at those next time around.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.